This interview for the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project is with Philip D. Curtin, a member of the University of Wisconsin History Department since 1956, and the Melville J. Herskovitz Professor of History from 1970 to 1975. I suppose before we talk about why you're leaving the University of Wisconsin, maybe we should start with what brought you here in the first place.
Well, I guess I'd have to say it's pure chance. It turned out that at the time in the Affairs of the Department, about 1955, Paul Maplin had just retired, and there'd been some struggle within the department between Paul on one hand and another group led mainly by Fred Harrington on the other, as to whether Paul should be allowed to appoint one of his own PhDs as his successor. And this was a period just after Paul had been ousted from the chairmanship by a rebellion of the younger men, and there was some feeling he should not be allowed to appoint his own successor. So the people began looking elsewhere for somebody in British Empire history. And they also decided at that time that they probably had too much emphasis, too much on the outer non-European world. Latin American history wasn't in very good repute generally through the country. The people had felt that they'd done too much Latin American history at the period of the Good Neighbor Policy and were tending to cut back. So the decision this department reached, as I understand it, was that they would get rid of two problems at once. They would appoint somebody who wasn't Paul's graduate student, and at the same time fill in the Latin American gap by appointing somebody who could teach both Latin American and British Empire history. Once this decision is made, they cut a very slim line indeed. There probably would have been three people in the country that had the combined background in British Empire and Latin American history, and I wasn't in fact a principal specialist in either, having taken up British Empire only at the very end of my graduate career. I'd been trained in European history, but I did teach British Empire at that time, and I'd had a lot of experience in Latin America, and I'd written a PhD thesis on Jamaica, which looked Latin American, so that having cut the size of the appointment, or having defined the appointments as narrowly as that, there were only about two people they could hire. And it turned out that I'd met Vernon Carstensen somewhere at a meeting, so Vernon suggested they have a look at my book and invite me out here, and I came out and was hired.
Well, that was a long time ago. That was in, what, 1956?
That would be 1956. March 1956. Yeah.
Well, since you've just described your activities as being somewhat British Empire and somewhat Latin America, what focused your attention on African history particularly?
Well, I'd been in African history. This was a period, you have to remember, when there wasn't anybody teaching African history as such anywhere in the country. There were some courses in what then was called Negro history in some of the black schools in the South. There was a course on Africa at Yale, Africa in general, both history and current events. But there was no such thing as African history, so that I had an interest in African history from my first year in graduate school, and had indeed done seminar papers on Africa, and had done my PhD thesis on African culture in the New World. But my interest was principally not so much on Caribbean history as on African history, and that was what I intended to do with further research. But since there was no job in the country in African history, I couldn't obviously pretend to be one, so I did something that covered that by defining myself as a British Empire man and taking that on the side. I'd been in Africa in 1955 in the summer, and had begun work on a further research topic, which ended up as a book called The Image of Africa. So that work was already well underway by the time I came here. So my research was on Africa at that time. And it was only then, after I'd been here for a year, that I was able to deliver an ultimatum. I didn't really deliver an ultimatum so much as to say I thought I'd like to teach African history, and it was said that by the chairman at the time that we didn't teach African history, and what would I do about the things I was obliged to teach by terms of my employment? And I said, if I didn't teach African history, I would go elsewhere and teach it so that they could choose between having me teach it here or having me teach it there. And so they gave in and let me teach a course. And it grew on from that into a full-year course. It was only a first one-semester course at first. On the previous year, however, we did have the first graduate seminar in African history taught here. We already had a graduate seminar, which I taught jointly with John Fage. But I could do that by simply defining my graduate seminar, giving it a new title, or calling it British Empire Africa. It was, in fact, all of Africa, not just British Africa, but that light label me to get that in the spring of 57. Which was the first graduate seminar in African history, I think, in the country, simultaneous with one taught by Dan McCall at Boston University that same semester.
Now, when exactly did the African Studies program officially start?
That came somewhat later. We started out about that time in the late 50s. I was on leave in Africa in 58, 59. And both before I left and after I came back, there were then about four people in the university here doing African studies of any kind. Frederickson Moons in anthropology, Frederickson Moons in geography, a man in anthropology, and a couple of others whose names I don't remember just at the moment. And we did pass our graduate students back and forth by simply advising somebody to take courses taught by the other people. And it didn't seem essential at that point to try and formalize an African Studies program until it grew a little bigger. By about 1960, 61, it had reached a critical mass that meant it needed a little more formal organization. And so we organized formally what had been in existence informally. Back as far as 1957, and this was the beginning of the African Studies program, which is then went ahead and grew to be much, much larger in succeeding years.
Were there any particular problems in getting this organized?
Well, there are always problems because no university likes to do something new, although people like to do new things more in Fred Harrington's time than they have in recent periods. The biggest problem was a problem of university priorities here. There was a sense at the time that, among some people anyhow, that a university ought not to try to cover the history and culture of the whole world, that it ought to specialize in something, to do American history and culture, and then specialize outside of that. And some universities, like Northwestern, had already done this and had an African Studies program, but had no other studies programs outside of the Western world. The one question then is whether this university should specialize in something outside of its present, the things it then had. It had a Scandinavian Studies program then. I think it's beginning to have an Indian Studies program. It had a Latin American Studies program with some standing, and people said, well, why do we need Africa too? Why don't we develop the things we can do best? Harrington was very good on this, and some other people, in feeling that some university, and this university might well be a good one to do this, some university ought to try to do all culture areas of the world, not evenly with some specialization, but at least to try to cover all of them. That the world is a whole world, and if they do, they teach something somewhere else, it really doesn't do us any good here. So that the decision here was not unfavorable to it, but there was some feeling that because Northwestern already had an African Studies program, and Northwestern was not very far away, that really one was all right for the Middle West. One was all that was needed for the Middle West. And that the plan sponsored by the Ford Foundation, or a committee set up by the Ford Foundation that made its report in 1950, '58, in the fall of '58 or summer of '58, in which it tried to look ahead and decide what should happen to African studies in this country. And the committee's decision was that there should be one major African studies program on the East Coast and one in the Middle West and one in the Far West. And this was part of the basis for Ford's support to the program at Boston University and the program at Northwestern and the program at UCLA. The way it worked out in the long run is interesting, because today the three large programs in African studies are UCLA, Madison, Northwestern, and Indiana. That is, it was thought that one was enough for the Middle West, but it turns out now three of the best are in the Middle West, and the program in Boston is comparatively minor, although it's had some active life. And the program at UCLA is perhaps still the biggest of the three, although it's very close between UCLA and Madison at present. So these things do grow in ways that are not predictable.
At that time, how did you counter this objection?
We got permission from the administration to form an African Studies Committee. And since it was a program, not a department, it didn't have to have any budgetary lines, and we were able to work with informal support from people in the administration. In effect, Ed Young, who was then the dean of LNS, would say to me, well, you can hold out the promise to, say, the Department of Sociology, that if they will hire an Africanist, they can get money that I have specially laid out for an African appointment. And that will be in addition to what they might have in the way of new slots in any event. And this was a way of persuading different departments like sociology to appoint an Africanist. We purposely set out to have the program be a program, not a department, and to have it as much departmentalized as possible so that it worked with a minimum of administrative staff. Much of the early period, it was simply me and a part-time student secretary. But if the departments would then see to it that they hired, say, the best sociologist they could find, who was also an Africanist, the African studies cause would be better served than it would be if we hired an Africanist and, say, put him in the Department of African Studies, because then he would be, if he had a sociological background in his discipline, he would be inevitably in some kind of conflict with people in the department. Whereas if he is in the department, he is their man, they hired him, all we did was to try and help get a budget line approved for him, then it's we have our spy, in effect, inside his department, and they don't feel that we are unfriendly to them. And this is the way the program was built in the early years, with very, very little administrative monetary assistance. Neither the NDEA nor the Ford Foundation gave us any grants at all until the program had reached a medium size, say 10, 12 people here in African Studies in different departments. This is, I think, an interesting thing in any case, because this was a period when what was called soft money was around a great deal in from Ford Foundation or government money. And many people like Columbia, many other universities like Columbia, did build African Studies programs mainly on soft money. Then when the soft money disappeared in the early 70s, they were left with the necessity of either taking it over and putting it, and making it a regular part of the budget, or of simply abandoning it. And the African Studies program at Columbia really has effectively disappeared. Whereas the African Studies program here could go on perfectly well if it had no outside money at all, because it's built into the regular work of a whole series of departments. And this was our feeling at the time, is I think we were right about this. And I think that I would carry this over, just to digress a second, into the problem of Afro-American studies when it was being set up in the late 60s. If it had done the same thing and kept itself departmentalized rather than having a separate department, I think its career would have been more successful.
Worked within the existing departments.
Worked within the existing departments, yeah. But now I've digressed a long way off. What would you like me to talk about?
Where would you like to go next?
Well, I don't know. While I'm talking about the early times, I might come into the relationship between this program and the Comparative World History Program, which I was also involved in the late 50s and early 60s. And I was really more concerned with that than I was with the program, the African Studies program at that time, because I felt that some things needed to be changed in the way history was taught in this country generally, and it seemed that this was an open and receptive university for making such changes. This is one reason I liked it when I first came here. And I was encouraged very much by Fred Harrington to try to get some outside money and build a program of comparative history within the history department. In fact, this is really quite remarkable about the way Fred operated in those days. He called me in. I was an assistant professor at the time, or maybe a first-year associate professor, but I'd been here a very short time. And he said that he'd heard me talking about what I thought ought to be done in history, and he knew I had some ideas about teaching about non-Western history. And did I realize, he said to me, that these were ideas that could be made profitable not only to the university but to myself. And he said to me, wouldn't you like to have every third year off for research? Wouldn't you like to have money for your graduate students? Wouldn't you like to have some money to hire other people of the same attitude toward history you have? And he said, if you take this program to the Carnegie Corporation or some other body and Rockefeller Foundation and write up a good proposal, you can certainly raise some money. Yeah, well, I never knew about this at all. This was something that was completely beyond anything I'd had to do with a PhD candidate or any other way.
Now, you're not talking about when Fred Harrington was president
He was vice president.
When he was
vice
president.
Yeah. And this would have been either spring of 58 or the fall of 59. Probably the fall of 59. He might just have been president then. I can remember the office he was in, but I can't remember whether it was the president's office then or the vice president's office.
I think he must have still been the vice president then.
But in any event, with his encouragement, I wrote up a proposal for a program in comparative tropical history, it was then called, which was to involve comparisons between Latin America, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia. Given the fact that I was the only person teaching in any of these fields, it was a pretty audacious proposal to take to any foundation. Indeed, the Rockefeller Foundation said, well, look, this is all very well, but you've only got you. And I know you're going to have a Latin Americanist coming soon because John Phelan had already been hired at that point, but that's not enough. So they turned us down, and we took it over to the Carnegie Corporation, who bought it and funded us reasonably handsomely. I think the first grant was $215,000 with a follow-up, which is $150,000-$160,000 altogether. And this was then the beginning of a program that's in the long run, very successful. We've now turned out something like 60 PhDs, and there are now 15 or 16 members of this department involved in the program, one way or another. And I think it's one of the things where the foundation got a great deal for the comparatively small amount of money they put in. But it came at a time when non-Western history was beginning to develop generally, and it was one of the few concerted efforts to develop non-Western history. Its idea, by the way, was not that comparisons, there are all kinds of comparative history one can talk about, but the main idea was not that it was to turn out comparatists, but that it was to turn out good specialists in the history of some non-Western area who also had a broader base of comprehension and background in world history generally. And this is what the sense in which comparative was used. in the program, so that it's objective was to turn out good non-Western history specialists in some particular field. And this, I think, is what it did.
Where have these people gone?
Oh, they're all over the place. The they're very widely scattered. Most of them are well placed, not all. But there's one at UCLA. There's one at Berkeley. There's one at Dartmouth. There was one at Harvard till we hired him back.
Who was that?
Bill Brown, and we were able to get him back. He's one of the best we've had. There's the principal Africanist at Northwestern, two at Rutgers, one at Virginia, one at the University of Florida. They're very widely scattered through the American and Canadian universities. There are two. There's one at the School of Oriental African Studies in London. There's one at the University of Glasgow. And there's one at the Aberystwyth in England. Two or three or four in Canada. I could provide you with a survey we made recently who everybody was and where they are. But they have been generally speaking well placed through the country, and several of them are among the best people now, the younger people in their profession, especially of the Latin Americanist and of the Africanist.
Well, I suppose while we're talking about developing programs, the one more that needs to be spoken of is the African Languages and Literature. How did that come about?
Well, this was something that came about because through my function actually as chairman of the African Studies program, and it was clear in the early 60s that no African Studies program in this country was going to be successful unless it was combined with some training in African languages. So that my own first concern about a program which was then and has continued to be outside of the African language department, essentially a social science oriented program, my first concern was with getting good courses in African languages which would serve as background resources for people studying social sciences. The problem we then had, or that foreign languages have generally had, non-Western foreign languages have generally had, is the question of where they can fit into a university program. And very often African languages had up to that time been taught as illustrations of linguistic problems or ways of having ways of speaking a language, rather than for the sake of the language itself. And very often African languages were taught by having not having a teacher who actually knew the language well himself, but by having a teacher who would himself be a structural linguist who would teach through an informant who knew the language. The structural linguist would know what questions to ask, would ask the informant the questions, and then the informant would explain it, and on it would go. Now, this is a very effective way to teach a language if you're going to teach simply as a tool. On the other hand, the question was, if you're going to teach language, if you're going to have a development of African languages, is it enough to stop to have these languages just be tools, or if you're going to have a real African studies program that's going to cover the contributions to African studies from all the disciplines, would it not be better to go ahead and see if you can study the African languages as works of literature or as a vehicle for literature, just as you study French, German, Italian, or whatever? And we talked this over a good deal among the people in African studies and among linguists and others outside, and decided that the thing to do would be to try to make a break from the past practices of other universities and to set up a department which would be a full department of African languages and literature, and would, which is, it was the first department of African language and literature anywhere in the world. In fact, I think it still is the only one. But,
yeah.
But it, what it did was to decide, to make the decision that languages were to be taught by people who knew the language, because if you didn't do that, you couldn't ever teach the literature, obviously. That is, you can be a structural linguist and work with a man, an informant, who tells you how his language is put together, but the structural linguist will not know the language well enough to appreciate its literature, obviously. And so the decision then was made to try to get all the people teaching in the department, people who really did know the language they were teaching and know it quite well. This meant that we were limited to a few of the major languages, but this was not a bar. And we started off with Xhosa, that's X-H-O-S-A, South African language, which is actually a part of a larger Nguni group of languages. We're all together, maybe 20 million speakers. And we had Professor A.C. Jordan here from South Africa, who introduced that. Then Swahili, which is obviously a national language for much of East Africa, and Hausa from northern Nigeria, again a language with all three being languages with more than 20 million speakers. So that these were major languages, and they all had a literature, or either some day a written literature, an oral literature that had been written down even by then, and some had a very wealthy oral literature which had not yet been explored, but has now been explored more, including research done by people in our own program or in our own department. So that the decision was made to have a full department, and what we did, it was one of the more amusing things in my own career as an academic administrator. What we did was we set out, and in order to get the department created, it had to go to the Board of Regents. So we had to have a full description of what the department would do and what its requirements would be. And I sat down one Sunday afternoon, I remember very well, and looked through the catalog at the Department of English and French and German, Russian, and saw how they put things together. And I sat down, and within 2 hours, I wrote the full set of requirements for BA, MA, and PhD. And they, curiously enough, stayed. Once they were in type and solidified, they stayed even when the full department had finally been hired and I was no longer connected with it. They still were the regulations of the department. The memory of man runneth not to the contrary. And I've sat and listened to discussions that ran as long as 2 and even 3 hours, discussing whether one small part of that very hastily constructed program should be changed, because first, once people get here, there are interests involved in changing a course requirement and so on, whereas if you're just imitating the Department of French or the Department of Italian, there are no interests involved and you can make quick decisions all by yourself. Once people came to do the teaching, then it was no longer possible. But the program, the language department, I think has been a success too. And although I'm a little worried that I wished I would feel better about it if it had been imitated more than it has, most places still keep African languages pretty well under the domination of the linguistically oriented people without the combination of linguistics and literature that we tried to have here.
Do you have any hope that this will change?
Not soon. It may somewhat, but now that universities are shrinking and people are considering things like African language as a frill that they can do without, the problem is to resist decline rather than to try to grow in most universities. And this is not, therefore, a time when innovations are likely to be sought.
Would you tell me a little bit about what the university and the history department was like when you first came?
Well, it was an extremely pleasant place to be then, for lots of reasons that are not still the case sometimes. Some things are still the case. It's obviously a very pleasant setting. Madison was in a much smaller town than now. It's only 20 years ago, but the growth here has been enormous. And the thing that was most striking was both a deficit and an asset was the kind of easy flexibility to the way the university was run. The administrative apparatus had not developed to the extent that it now has. It was easy to get to see a dean. It was easier to keep in contact with one's colleagues in the history department than it is now. It was easy to if you had some ideas about the way education ought to be done in your own field, it was then easy comparatively to get these ideas accepted by other people. There was an innovation, a university very open to innovation. A lot of this was Fred Harrington's own personal quality, but it was also something that ran generally through the university at this time and was a real eye-opener to me, coming as I did from a graduate background at Harvard, and where things were very stiff and regimented and very slow to change, and no general change in their program could have been contemplated, certainly not one based on ideas of people who were as junior as I was at that time. So that it was an extremely easy place to be then. Well, just as an example of the kind of thing that was possible in 1960, I'd been in Africa in 1958-59, and during that time I met a very bright young historian who also had a strong background in anthropology, a Belgian named Jan van Sina. And I'd seen a lot of him in what was then Leopoldville, now Kinshasa, and then again up in Rwanda at Astrida, where he was director of a Belgian government research center. I had admired his work and thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice sometime if we could get him to pay a visit to Wisconsin, because he would contribute a lot to our program. He's a specialist in the working with oral sources of history. And the following year, and if you remember, the Congo blow-up came into the 1st of July, 1960. And the following fall, I was coming back from an African Studies Association meeting with Alan Merriam, who was then at Northwestern, and Alan is also a Congo specialist, and mentioned that he'd seen van Sina somewhere or other and had found that he was then looking for a job. His job in the Congo was over, in Rwanda was over, and he was going to have to leave and go somewhere else. Well, this was obviously a very great opportunity, because the promise that van Sina showed at this time was that he was the outstanding historian of Africa anywhere around, and certainly without question the outstanding historian of Africa among those who worked with oral tradition. So this was on a Friday night, I guess, so the next morning, without waiting for Monday, I wandered around to Fred Harrington's home, and he was mowing his lawn. We sat in front of him, in front of his house, and I remember talking very well and talked to him, and he said, "Well, this is obviously an opportunity we can't miss." He was then vice president. "It's an opportunity we can't miss. I'll tell you what I'll do. It seems to me that this is something that you can raise money from the Rockefeller Foundation. But I'll backstop it. That is, if you don't raise the money, I'll put in from funds I control a salary for 1 year. Meanwhile, though, you can start trying to raise money from Rockefeller, and you can also go to the Department of History and say that you can have a salary for 1 year, that I backstopped it, could they appoint the man for 1 year?" And so you can do that Monday, but meanwhile, he said, "Why don't you call him, find out where he is, whether he's available, whether he could be got here." So with this, just an informal conversation like that was all that was needed, because the history department would, of course, normally anyhow, appoint a man for 1 year. It's a temporary matter. All you needed was the backstop money in order to start the thing, the ball rolling. So I went home and the next day called Vanzina in Belgium, just outside of Antwerp, and found out that he wasn't there, that he would be away in Africa till the end of that following week, that is for 7 days. By the time he got back, we were able to have our offer of employment in his hands, in writing, by airmail.
Before he got back to Belgium.
It took 1 week. To now, this may not seem fast in other contexts, but today you would have to have committees, you would have to have priorities, you'd have to have long, elaborate, regimented way of going about making an appointment like this. And indeed, that's what the other universities did at that time. By the time they got around to making him offers at London and one or two other places, he already was in Madison.
That's very nice.
And he's one of the principal assets to our program here, as it goes without saying. So that this is the kind of thing you could do then. Now, you could say that, well, to do this, Harrington has to have confidence in me. Well, that may be so, but not really. If I goof on this, all he's lost is the backstop money.
For 1 year.
For 1 year. I've had to go to get the money from Rockefeller. He's pushed the whole thing off on me and let me do it. Because if it works, it's a good thing, and if it doesn't work, there's no loss. And he was willing to do that kind of thing, and other people at that time could do that kind of thing in ways that simply have turned out to be impossible in the longer run. And I guess that was the thing that made this university the most pleasant in those years of growth. Now, let me backtrack a minute here to point out something about this, looking back over the last 20 years. If you hadn't had growth, you couldn't have done the things that were possible then. If without the growth in the university as a whole, it would have been impossible to make this university into the kind of, give this history department the kind of reputation it now has as the first history department anywhere in the world, I think, to really systematically teach a PhD level program in all major culture areas of the world. This is the first place where history became world history and not just the history of Western civilization plus one or two other things. Now that growth in non-Western history would have been impossible without growth in the size of the university altogether, because if it's easy enough to develop a new branch of the department, as long as new appointments are not taking away from positions already present. If, for example, a classicist resigns, there would be very strong pressure to appoint another classicist and not to let that man's courses drop simply because you needed somebody new in the history of Southeast Asia. Even if there are two classicists already in the department and no historian of Southeast Asia, obviously, most people in the department thought it should be that way, or they would long since have done it differently. And historians are very conservative people, so that it would have been absolutely impossible to do anything in the direction of growth in new directions without the growth in the university as a whole. Okay, now, this being the case, the growth in the university as a whole also has, in the longer run, a price. And the price is the super bureaucratization, the increase in administrative personnel, the dying out of the opportunity to have informal personal contact with people in the administration, the kind of development, in other words, that made it possible in the early days to handle people, to deal with Fred Harrington over the hiring of Vanzina in an informal way.
In his backyard.
Yeah, that kind of informal backyard university setting had to go with growth. It was something that couldn't last. It couldn't survive growth. At the same time, without the growth, the kind of development that we were able to put in through just this kind of informal contact would have been impossible. So that it's one of these cases of growth killing itself, or growth being useful at a development stage, but then cutting off further development that might take place in these areas.
Eventually self-defeating.
It may be self-defeating. It's hard to tell. I've sometimes thought it's like the fermentation of wine. I'm a home winemaker. The wine, the fermentation turns the sugar into alcohol, as you know, till it reaches a certain point. And then the alcohol becomes so strong that it kills yeast, and then the fermentation process ends.
But then aging is supposed to help.
That comes later. During the stage before the alcohol, that is the administration, became so strong and so hidebound that it prevented any kind of innovation, then innovation and growth could take place together. Since then, innovation now has pretty well died out in this university, and growth, or in the parts that I know anyhow, and growth has, of course, stopped too. And we're stuck, it appears, with the kind of university that was created during the 1960s. How long that will go on, I don't know, but the size and shape and feel of the universities is apparently that was the outcome of the 60s. Yet the innovation that was possible during the 60s lay back in the early part of that decade rather than the second part of it.
Well, there were other factors at work in the second part, and a lot of turmoil and so forth.
The war, sure, the war came in too. But I'm trying to leave that out and just look at the university structure.
Well, I'd like to pursue this a little more, but not just yet. Would you talk a little bit about the history department itself during those early 60s? And what were the problems that you found?
Well, there was this kind of flexibility that I spoke of as being a good on the good side. There was the problem that I've already hinted at, and that is that historians are very conservative, and that basically what those of us who were the younger generation of historians at that time, what those of us who were of this younger generation wanted to do, was in fairly sharp conflict with what some of the older generation wanted to do. Now, let me make it quite clear, what by older and younger, I'm not speaking in strictly chronological terms. The Merle Curdy voted with the younger generation of the department until he retired at the age of 70. And we would have counted him as one of the younger people when he was in his late 60s, and some of my colleagues who were in their 30s or early 40s voted as though they were 60. So that it wasn't strictly a generational matter, but there was a generational passing over of power and influence in the department that took place in this period. And there were some very bitter battles fought between people who wanted to innovate in the history department and people who wanted to hold the line against innovation, some of these involving personality conflicts. Rondo Cameron at that period was one of the people who wanted to innovate in the field of economic history, and he had a number of personal conflicts with other members of the department, which tended to embitter and exacerbate the intellectual conflict over whether he should move forward or not. A lot of the people in the department at the time felt had conflicts with me, that if they thought that they felt that I was an empire builder, and anything I was trying to do in the way of developing world history or African history or program in comparative world history, as it became, was not an honest intellectual endeavor, but a cheap personal effort to gain advantage over the more traditional fields of history within the department. And I guess this is inevitable if you are going to have innovation, that you'll have some back resistance from the more traditional people. And we had a series of really very, very bitter battles that didn't result in any resignations, although they very nearly resulted in the resignation of the whole program as it then was. If we could have found somebody to take the whole program at another university, we would have gone. But that was only at the height of the battles. And it developed and finally into a situation where a group of more conservative people were finally defeated by votes in the department. That group would have been principally Merrill Jensen, who was to the younger generation was always the kingpin of our opposition, as the most conservative people in the department. But he was supported to some degree by Vernon Carstensen and people like Richard Current, mainly that is by people in U.S. history, to some degree by others in non-Western and in European history, but mostly people in U.S. history. And there were all kinds of projects around at the time, many of which we've now forgotten about. One issue that came up, for example, was a question of whether the department should be divisionalized, and we looked at the pattern of chemistry and some other departments and decided it should be divisionalized, or some of us thought it should be, that this is the only way we could protect our interest in non-Western history from what we thought of as undue control by people in the rest of the department. And that failed, curiously enough, in one decisive vote at one period. I can't remember the date. But what happened, oddly enough, a few years later was that the department was divisionalized and it turned into its present structure of having the three formal caucuses, one for non-Western, one for European, one for American history, be the way in which the department is run. So that we lost the battle, but what we wanted was done later on by somebody else.
Has this worked out? The way you
hoped? Well, it hasn't, as a matter of fact. What's happened over the years is that the people now, and I'm not giving my own opinion, but trying to speak of the sentiment of the department now, that I think the people at present in non-Western history feel that, rightly or wrongly, that they represent a tradition of rigorous historical scholarship more than the other divisions of the department. And they feel sometimes that the other divisions of the department are not sufficiently rigorous, and therefore they would like to have an opportunity to get back in and have a say in appointments that they feel are not as able people as they would like to see appointed, and a few other matters in the other division. So what happens, and has happened in recent years, to the extent that there's been any sentiment against the divisionalization, it's come from the non-Western history people who have wanted to induce or inject more rigor into the decisions made by other people, rigor in regard to the quality of historical scholarship and such matters as that. Let's say these are not my own views, but I'm trying to give a sense of what people have now been saying, so that in a sense things have turned around, and the people who were then trying to get divisionalization of the department in order to protect themselves from the other two now find that they, having won the victory, that they'd like to be interfering more in what other people are doing. So none of these things really quite work out perhaps in the way one expects them to. Then there was another flap of this period against people who raise money outside of the department.
Against
people who raise money outside of the department, outside foreign money, feeling that this brings in undue influence in the affairs of the department, and this was mainly directed at me, but there is a kind of a a curtain law, I guess, on the books of the department somewhere back about 1964 or 65, I guess, which makes it illegal to do what I had in fact done when the program of comparative world history was set up. That is, makes it illegal to go to, for a member of the history department, to go and raise money from, say, the Carnegie Corporation for some purpose of historical nature, unless, if any of the money is to be spent on departmental affairs, without the full permission of the department in advance. That is, it would be possible to raise money for your own personal research, but if you want to raise money for the research of your colleagues, for historians generally, then this could only be done
for
a program that could only be done with the history department's prior approval. Well, this was a kind of last gasp of the people who thought we shouldn't have set up the comparative world history program anyway. And it was, I guess it was directed at me and at Rondo Cameron, and that too passed. That it was voted through, and nothing ever happened about it. It simply was let lie there. And
has it hampered you in any way?
Well, any time I've raised, I've been very careful not to raise any money for the history department again, so that any money I've raised in from outside sources, I've been careful to see that it did not involve the history department, but involved African studies or people in economic history or people who were not in this department. This was not just to avoid problems if they should arise. But I think, in fact, that nobody, perhaps except me in the department today, even remembers that that was passed. It's one of these things that was long enough ago that it's not part of the consciousness of present members of the department.
But it's curious they should have felt like that way.
Yes, well, it's a little bit. It was a little bit of an effort. It was a last gasp effort to prevent the change in the way history was being carried on at this university. And the position of the young people at that time, who are now the middle-aged people, aging people, I guess, really, the position that they took then was not simply in favor of non-Western history, but in favor of a broader conception of what historical subject matter should be. It was, first of all, I think, ethnocentric. That is, it was. It tried to avoid ethnocentricity, and most of us felt that our tradition of historical scholarship was far too much ethnocentric. That is, we were not necessarily against European history, because several of us were special. I mean, American history. Several of us were specialists in American history. But we were against having American history taught without any regard or knowledge of where the American experience sat in relation to other experiences in world history. And one result of this interest was a development of a short-lived program in comparative history, which was not comparative world history, but comparative history between the United States and Europe. Those who were interested in this have all now gone, so that it's died, but this was part of the effort at the time, was to avoid ethnocentricity. And the other thing we were trying to avoid was elitism. The older history, it seemed to us, was far too elitist. It was a history of great men, great ideas, not the history of ordinary people, or the history of ideas that were held by lots of people and were therefore important in making history what it was, but were not in and of themselves admirable. So that a lot of us thought that intellectual history, the history of ideas, should be the history of all ideas, not just of great ideas. And the history of people should be the history of people and not just the history of great people. So that this was part of a general movement that's going on in history today, trying to involve history of the family, history of behavioral history, history of social classes not represented previously, and obviously in the kind of thing I do, history of non-Western societies. So these were all part of a battle that then got into then became part of a generational fight. And I guess it was probably over by about 1968, 1969. I think the battles within the history department had been overtaken by other concerns, and the issue as it was drawn in the early 60s was now then settled in favor of the younger people, or the people who had been the younger group at that earlier period.
So you broke out of this elitism.
Well, we tried. I don't know. No victory is total, and the department began to run into other problems, so that the issue isn't even an issue anymore. Almost everybody in the department now would broadly agree with the position that those of us who were in the younger generation were trying to bring forward in the early part of the 1960s. And this did change the nature of the department. The Department of Wisconsin was thought to be one of the stiffest and most stodgy, most conservative, most anti-innovative in the country. At the time I first was going to graduate school, this was the impression I had of Wisconsin. It turned out not to be so, but the change was really a change in that early period. I was not the leader of it, I was simply one of the participants.
Could we spend a few minutes now maybe talking about your particular role in the department, your teaching, your courses, your students?
Well, as I said earlier along, I was originally brought here to teach British Empire and Latin America, and over the years I've followed a rather curious movement in my own teaching. Well, it's going back to before my career here. I originally had an interest in European expansion overseas and in African history, neither of which could be taught formally. So that in graduate school I did a series of fields, as they were called then, in history: medieval France, Renaissance and Reformation, modern England, and modern France. By the time I first came here, I was no longer teaching any of those things, but was teaching, in fact, Latin America and British Empire. Then I switched once more and no longer stopped teaching both Latin America and British Empire. We hired John Phelan to take over the Latin America. The British Empire dropped for a time, and then hired somebody to take over that. And I began teaching African history, and of course, called The World in the West, which is mainly a course in comparative world history, and a seminar from time to time on comparative world history under that name. The curious development now is that as I go to Johns Hopkins, I will be teaching those and not African history anymore. So that I've gone through, and in fact I'm now off on a third bunch of courses, which I've been teaching a little bit all the time, the comparative courses, but these will be the main body of my work as far as teaching goes at Hopkins, whereas they make a further movement along some kind of course. So that my career has been a little different from most, I think, in that I've moved fields more times than most people have, and I don't regret it. It's awfully time-consuming to learn new fields, but at least you don't have any preconceptions about fields you're just taking up as opposed to a field you've had around and embodies a lot of your older ideas. So that's been one change that I've gone through. The coming down to a more institutional aspect of teaching, of course, we have had a curious situation here of training probably more people in African history than any other university in the country, and maybe I don't know how many we've tried to train, perhaps a quarter of all the Africanist historians now practicing, certainly a quarter of the more prominent ones who are full-scale Africanist historians as opposed to those who teach a course in Africa on the side. And this has meant that over the years, Vancina and I, and then later on Stephen Fireman joining us, had a very heavy load of graduate teaching, of simply thesis supervision and the like.